Hello, and welcome to the Ecocentrics. I'm PK.
And I'm Tom. And this week, we're going to be talking about heat, heat, heat.
In the last week, there have been many, many, many headlines about our hot summer.
Both in the UK, across Europe, and all around the world.
So how much hotter has this year been compared to previous years?
And what is the impact?
Over the last week, the global average temperature has reached a high 3 days in a row, which is pretty significant. So on a Monday, the global average temperature was 17.01 Celsius for our American friends who still don't understand anything Celsius or metric. That's about 62 degrees Fahrenheit. But then it was broken again just the very next day, and it was 17.18 Celsius. And then on Thursday, that same week, it was broken yet again at 17.23. All of this is pretty sad. It's compounded by a number of things, but human-induced greenhouse gas emissions, fossil fuels are definitely contributing to it. But it's also combining at a specific time with a natural environmental system called El Niño, or more specifically, the El Niño Southern Oscillation System, ENSO. It sounds like that should be a character in a cartoon.
Yeah, and it's just not surprising in many ways. But at the same time, it's surprising how quickly these things are changing. And what's really concerning, obviously, is the fact that the El Niño event we're going through is just starting. We're just starting to tip towards that El Niño cycle. And as we spoke about in one of our earlier episodes, the El Niño cycle releases heat into the atmosphere from the ocean. And in doing so, it will raise global temperatures. And this is a natural cycle. It does happen. And as we've spoken about before, there's El Niño and there's La Niña events. But this El Niño is expected to be a super El Niño event. And I think the news that stood out to me today was listening to the BBC weather presenter saying, in Sicily, temperatures might get up to 49 degrees Celsius. And that is just an outrageously hot day. I struggle in anything above about 23. I can't imagine what it's like at double that.
Yeah. And I mean, for some people that live in other countries where there's something called this magical but highly energy intensive thing called air conditioning, we don't have that in many of our homes in Europe. So that is just an overwhelming, blistering, mortal heat event that happens here, because we just, our homes and our lives aren't designed for to be able to tolerate that kind of heat system.
I was at a friend's house over the weekend, and one of the people who lives with us from Malaysia, and she couldn't get over the fact we didn't have air conditioning in our house, because obviously Saturday just gone, that night was so hot. It was unbearably warm. I remember waking up 8 in the morning and thinking, oh, I guess I'm up for the day now, just because it was too hot to do anything.
3 a.m. Might as well get up and start the day. That's 120 for my American friends who are listening, 120 Fahrenheit. It's pretty intense.
Not just in Europe. This is happening all over the world. Last week, 120 million Americans were under a heat advisory status. PK, you might be able to tell me a bit more about what that is. I struggle to understand it, but it seemed like something concerning and a lot of Americans under that status.
Yeah, and that covered several states. But the heat advisory is so intense that they just don't even want you to go outside. I think we have humidity here in the UK, but it feels very, very different to me. In Florida, you open your door and just a regular summer, the humidity is a physical entity. It is like an actual barrier. It is not, you know, not nearly as intense as like wading into the water, but it's there and it impacts all manner of things. And then, of course, when it's really, really hot like that, it's much harder for you to regulate your temperature. So, yeah, it's quite a big deal in the United States when they give those heat advisory warnings. But it impacts people that have to work outside, construction workers, people who normally work in the environmental systems. It's pretty intense. It was a heat dome, actually.
And what this really takes me back to is a book I read several years ago by Kim Stanley Robinson called The Ministry for the Future. And the opening chapter of that book, they talk about Pakistan during a wet bulb event.
Wet bulb?
So this is when you have humidity at 100% and temperature above 32. And it is physically impossible to survive outside. And this book is a fictitious future, thinking about what happens going to happen in our warming world. And it lays out some of the things that we'll see over the next 10, 20, 30 years. What's going on today with our temperature systems is kind of bringing me back to that moment, reading that book and Kim Stanley Robinson describing the thousands and thousands of people in this environment, which just can't survive anymore. And the major ramifications that has, not only to obviously the people that are directly impacted, but the whole way that our world works, the interconnected nature of it, and how that impacts our global system.
To talk about the El Nino impact a little bit more, it is a natural system. It is a natural occurring event that occurs about every 3 to 7 years. And sometimes people go, what's the big deal? These are natural systems that occur on the planet. And yes, they are. However, the important thing is with an ever-increasing warming planet, these systems become greater and greater in their intensity. And El Nino is the most powerful fluctuation in the climate system anywhere on the planet. It has a massive impact. So the fact that this is something that occurs every 3 to 7 years and is heavily influenced by heat and then also exacerbates heat, that's something to think about with our human-induced contributions to global warming.
And it's also worth saying that even without the El Nino effect, last year was a catastrophe for heat too. A study actually came out earlier this week in the journal Nature, which estimated that somewhere between 40,000 and 85,000 people died in Europe as a result of heat. And that's just from the heat wave that there was last summer. So a phenomenal amount of life lost because of this warming world. And in 2022, overall, 850 million people experienced an all-time temperature record being broken.
Wow, 850 million people. That's incredible. In terms of those people who died in 2022, almost 6,000 of those would have been in Wales and England alone. So the impact that has on our healthcare systems, which are already strained, but additionally, in terms of it's a loss of life that doesn't necessarily need to occur, but will continue to rise as temperatures continue to rise on a warming planet.
And I think what's worse about it as well is it impacts people who are vulnerable more, people who don't have the capacity to pay for air conditioning, people who live in high-rise buildings who can't escape the heat and the heat is trapped within it, people who live in cities who get impacted by the urban heat island effect, where black surfaces literally act as a battery which store heat energy and release it overnight, meaning you can't escape the heat. And also, actually, women are disproportionately affected. And this study looked into that in detail and found that women were the people that were the vast majority of times dying as a result of heat-related incidents.
That's true. We'll link some of this information in the show notes so everybody will have access to it as well. So I will say climate scientists actually didn't find this surprising. I mean, it's distressing to them. Due to these heat accelerations, just this past week in the state of Florida, and for those of you who've listened to the podcast, you know, I used to live in Florida. It's always ever present in my mind, but it's also a good indicator of what is happening in climate change in terms of water and wildlife. And they anticipate a huge bleaching event to happen on the corals of Florida due to these unexpectedly high rates of temperature increases, which, as we noted before, it's early in the season. Temperatures are continuing to rise and expected they rise. I remember when I was in Florida, August was a really, really hot month. So right now we're just in July. So the sudden marine heat wave is threatening the most severe coral bleaching event that the state has ever seen. And in fact, Derek Manzello is the coordinator for NOAA Coral Reef Watch, said this appears to be unprecedented in all of their records. And coral reef systems are sort of like a bottom tier foundation for other biodiversity ecosystems. If that collapses, there is a knock-on effect down the road. 25% of marine life systems can sort of be linked back to coral. And that's because coral provides shelter. It's basically housing for certain kinds of species that gather there. Different animals lay their eggs near corals, but also there are certain fish and crustaceans that have their start their lives in coral reef areas. And of course, those are food systems. Those are food for other bigger fish, other bigger predators, and that has a knock-on effect. So Florida at the moment expects bleaching to start occurring this week, and they expect coral die-off to be within a month. So what ends up happening is they go bleachy because the algae they consume, they end up not being able to do that. It releases. That's why it goes white. So it's really algae, sort of the food they eat, that gives them those interesting colors. They won't be able to do that. They'll starve to death. And then eventually they will collapse as a structure as well. So they will unable to be habitats for these other animals.
Do they eat the algae? I think it's a symbiotic relationship with it, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's a relationship. Yeah, it's their food.
It's so cool, the fact that they work together. Like the fact that like things just collaborate in nature. And we're like, nah, we're not a fan of that, to be honest. Let's just be competitive.
And in addition to this, so this is the biodiversity. This is how it affects the biodiversity. But in addition to this, for people who are more concerned about economic systems and financial markets, in the state of Florida alone, you know, coral reefs contribute billions of dollars to the economy through the activities like fishing and tourism. And so if you don't have those coral reefs, and just to let you know, 70% of Florida's coral reefs have bleached or eroded in a very short period of time, that, you know, that really impacts other forms of revenue. And when I lived in Florida, even though we had a love-hate relationship with the tourists, they provided a lot of revenue, but it meant that our taxes were lower. So in the United States, you have a federal tax, which is the tax that everybody has to pay. In some states, you then have to pay much more in taxes on your salary because you don't have as much money coming from tourism. So for instance, when I moved from Florida to Georgia, my taxes increased by over 8%. So in Florida, you know, if you don't have these tourism, it can mean your taxes go up.
Yay, more taxes.
In addition to this, there's also other financial implications as well. And some of this has to do with insurance. Now, insurance is already high in Florida anyway, because we have something called hurricane season. And for people not in the know, this is an actual thing to us. We in Florida, this is just as much a season as any of the other four natural seasons of the year. So you have hurricane season where you're prepared, you have your hurricane kit, you always have a specific amount of water for each member of your family, you have extra medications, you have rechargeable batteries, you have your radio. A lot of people, if you can afford it, have a generator. And that's because you know you're going to lose power at some point throughout the year. And again, in a super hot state with high humidity like Florida and with a large pensioner population, you need to be able to ensure that you can turn on an AC and keep people cool. So you have hurricane season, and that has lots of other implications. Even if you don't get a hurricane off the coast of Florida, you will often be impacted by the storm surge, and you will have tornadoes and massive amount of flooding.
And I think what's really important to say with these hurricanes as well is that they, because of the heating we're seeing, they are becoming more vicious, more powerful, and forming quicker, particularly through this process called rapid intensification, which occurs as a result of the ocean surface temperature being hotter. Therefore, more water comes out, and therefore more water goes into the atmosphere quickly, creating the storm conditions at a quicker rate. And this is one of the major impacts of these sort of heat vents, is that they intensify these hurricanes and they form so much quicker. You might have seen stories around the world over the last few years of these super hurricanes or super typhoons which were emerging, which just wouldn't have happened beforehand, particularly in kind of the Bay of Bengal, where it was unprecedented to see this happen so fast because temperatures were rising so fast on the ocean surface. Actually, these hurricanes could form and move in quickly. And not only does that have the obvious economic and social impacts, but also it means that people will be less prepared for them because they happen quicker.
The storms are going to be more intense, more severe, more powerful, and less time frame to gear up for them. I remember moving from Florida and just being so relieved that I didn't have to think about storms as much. You still do have to think about it in Georgia and all along the east coast of the United States and in many of the southern areas in the Gulf of Mexico. So the states like Alabama, Louisiana, Texas as well. But it's a huge swath. But also hurricanes can hang out for a bit as well, causing massive storm surges. And the difficult challenge of it is you can predict a bit how a hurricane is going to move, but in some ways you're in a bit of abeyance as well. So it might be that you think it's going to go across in your area, but it ends up shifting last minute and going up another coast. So it just regular hurricane season is a challenge, is an emotionally challenge as well. But again, it also impacts the most vulnerable and the least financially flexible people as well. So for instance, my family, they might be able to afford to evacuate early, get a hotel room up in Georgia and get the house all prepared, shuttering the house, woodening it, protecting it, putting everything inside the house so you don't have anything outside to blow around and become a virtual, cannon into another object. But other people just don't have the luxury or the financial resources to get in a car, pay for hundreds of dollars worth of petrol, and then pay for a hotel in another location, and then pay for eating out all the time as well. So there's a whole system that is not just the environmental damage that occurs with this. There's so much severe stress that goes upon poor people and populations. And I was living in Florida when Katrina hit Louisiana, and I was actually working for a group in a law enforcement aviation section. And whenever you have those kind of disasters, all law enforcement from residing counties and states will go to help as well. And then there's emergency funds that come in. And I remember we were procuring lots of overalls, lots of waterproof clothing. And our teams went over there to help. And it was just so distressing to hear what was happening. And that was a terrible, terrible hurricane. But those kind of things will be happening with more frequency.
So we're obviously talking about these impacts that we're seeing today. But today we are at 1.1 to 1.2 degrees of warming above, on average, above pre-industrial times. At the moment, we're on track to see warming of in the region of around about 2.7 degrees by the end of the century. So getting up to three times more warming than we are already seeing today. And just to kind of do a bit of future gazing now about what that'll mean in terms of the heat that's associated with it and compared to what life's like today. At 2 degrees, we can expect around 37% of the global population to be exposed to a heat wave once every 5 years, which is a substantial increase in where we are before. And 70% of the global population experiencing a severe heat wave with major, major threats to life once every 20 years. In the UK, we'll expect to be seeing around about three times the amount of tropical nights that we see at the moment. And tropical nights are nights which are above 20 degrees, which I hate and I moan about and I'm miserable about them because I can't sleep in them. But we see three times more of these. Unless we adapt to these, we're going to have worse night's sleep. I'm going to be more grumpy. But also there's going to be major economic consequences as well, because actually our ability to sleep is also connected to our ability to be productive. And therefore we will expect to lose some of that in this process, unless we do something to adapt there. And I don't like GDP. I don't like economic growth as a measure of what we do. But for the people that do, that's an important thing. And this will not be good for that.
That's actually a good point. But for segments of the population that do utilize that as a metric and take that into consideration where they're doing policies and making legislative decisions, that's one way we could maybe get them on board more with the climate changes that need to be implemented to ensure that we're resilient and have a more solid footing.
What's terrifying about that, though, is that actually there is a well-respected climate economist called William Nordhaus. He got a Nobel Prize for his work on looking at what are called integrated assessment models, which look at the impact of climate change going into the future and the economic ramifications of it. And his model basically say that there will be limited impact on the economy as a result of climate change, therefore we should do nothing. And actually the economic benefits aren't reaped until we get to 3 degrees of warming. So we shouldn't limit warming unless it goes to 3 degrees, which is absolutely insane because of the state of the world we're seeing at the moment. All of the impact we're seeing, there was about 600 billion lost in climate damages between 2016 and 2018 already. Like, I don't know where he gets his numbers from to say there's going to be a limited impact on GDP. But also, what's concerning about this is this rhetoric and this science is quite mainstream in the political discourse. But when you drill down into his workings and his models, you start to see that they are fundamentally flawed. They don't integrate the fact that there are long-tail risks with climate change. So these risks of really bad things happening, he just assumes those things don't happen. He assumes that industry or any job working inside will not be impacted because it is a climate regulated space. So 86% of the global economy he just ignores. And also, he fails to recognize that there are these tipping points in our climate system. And we've already talked about these on a previous episode, and we can see we're starting to move towards some of these tipping points already, which will massively exacerbate the impacts of climate change. But our current modeling and the current assumptions which are being used in many cases to drive policy decisions are based on flawed science. Luckily, things are starting to change. The Stern Review in 2006 changed the discourse a bit in the UK. But still, there's this kind of hesitancy because some of the economic models say that there's no point doing anything.
That's really disappointing. And we should be able to update our models and understanding and policies as new emerging science indicates, and as, you know, scientists across the globe have been saying basically for 50 years, we've got to stop this. That is disappointing. And when you were talking about how he was saying, oh, well, it's not going to impact any industry that has to be inside, I was like, do they not have supply chains that are dependent on the natural world? Like, what is he talking about? I mean, we all depend on the natural world.
So a study was done earlier this year that was released looking at what are the impacts at 2.7 degrees, the pathway we're going on. And a lot of what they looked at was the impact of heat. And at 2.7 degrees compared to 1.5 degrees, which is the target we need to be aiming for, five times more people will be exposed to unprecedented heat. And that is an average mean temperature of above 29 degrees. And what's really interesting within this is that they showed that the lifetime emissions of 3.5 people living today, or 1.2 Americans, because they have a much bigger carbon footprint, will result in one future person being exposed to unprecedented heat by 2100. The three of us in this room, effectively, will be responsible for the unprecedented heat that one person experiences. And PK, you alone will be one person as an American, Americanite.
Well, I guess I'll just cancel that massive Amazon order I had. We've come to that part of our podcast where we do the quiz. All right, Tom, let's test your memory here. Which weather system, global weather system, is the most powerful fluctuation climate system anywhere on the planet? Is it the Aspen snow season? Is it ENSO, the El Nino Southern Oscillation, or a soon-to-be character in a Harry Potter film? Or is it the summer spring breakers from universities hitting Florida?
I imagine they have a major impact on the temperature there. Just like the amount of extra bodies kicking around the place. I'm going to go for answer B, please.
Yay! Ding, 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 ding. ENSO, the El Nino Southern Oscillation System. I just like the way that sounds. All right, next question. Just last month, there was a video that was making the newsreels, even in the UK. And in Florida, people had a video of a specific animal emerging from the Gulf of Mexico, running past all these happy beach revelers and heading off into the distance. What was this animal? A walrus? A koala? Or a bear?
I've got no idea. You can tell how bad I'm at popular culture. Jeez. Maybe it was a mixture of all three. Was it a koala bear?
It was actually a brown bear. And it was funny because this was on the beaches of Destin, where once upon a time I used to lifeguard. It's glorious. It's beautiful. It's sugar white beaches, Emerald Coast. That's what it's called. And it was a brown bear. And when my husband saw this, he sent it to me. He was like stunned. He was my British husband, just didn't know. And he goes, well, where's it going to go? And I said, it's probably going to go to the forest. And he goes, there are bears in Florida? I go, yes, honey. He didn't realize there were bears in Florida. It's not common to see them on the beach and just swimming around in the Gulf of Mexico, but we do have brown bears. Next question. Testing your memory, Tom. What percentage of marine life has a direct link to healthy coral systems? 95%, 50%, or 25%?
Because the number in my head was 80%, and that's not an option, which has thrown me well out of whack.
It's actually 25% of marine life across the global ecosystems, but that's still a big chunk. That's, you know, a quarter of marine life have a direct link with healthy coral systems. So if those collapse, there's trouble a-brewing. Literally a-brewing, the ocean is getting hot. Last and final question, Tom. Heat waves kill more people globally than tornadoes, flooding, hurricanes, or all three combined?
It's a morbid question.
I know. I'm really bad about this, aren't I? I think I'm very focused on death and mortality.
I'm going to say more than all of them, but flooding's throwing me off a little bit.
You're correct. Ding, 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 ding. Heat waves, in terms of weather-related extremes, heat waves kill more people annually than all other weather-related systems, fires, avalanches.
Wow.
So you've, I don't know how many you got right, actually.
I tried my best.
The bear was arguably, for a non-Floridian, you wouldn't have gotten that one.
I think I might have only got two, to be honest.
Well, we still love you.
And that is it for another episode of The Ecocentrics.
If you'd like to get in touch, then email us at hello@theecocentrics.com.
And find us on all manner of social media, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, LinkedIn, and also Threads.
And Instagram. It's just no end to these. But anyway, until next week, adios.
Bye.